Well, good morning, everyone. Lovely to see you all here. I'm looking forward to sharing this coming week with you, with the Harp Sutra and with Nagarjuna. I'll just say a wee bit about the, what we'll be doing and what it's about. So during the retreat this week, we'll be focusing our attention on emptiness in the traditional way of learning, reflecting, and meditating. And depending on how it goes, but probably for the first 4 days or so, we'll be guided by the Harp Sutra. The Harp Sutra is the shortest of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which start with the Perfection of Wisdom and in 100,000 lines and range through 38 sutras down to the Harp Sutra. The Harp Sutra is the essence of the Perfection of Wisdom. We'll be using the late Dr. Edward Conze's translation. That's the one that I've handed out to you, which is thought perhaps the most literal translation that's available. Then, towards the end of the week, probably the last 2 days, we're going to dive into Nagarjuna, to Nagarjuna's Mula Madhyamaka Karika, the fundamental wisdom of the middle way. Nagarjuna is said to be the founder of the Mahayana school of Buddhism, and he's more or less recognized as being second to the Buddha in the whole importance and history of Buddhism. The middle way, which is central to Nagarjuna's doctrine, that's the middle way between existence and non-existence. And as we'll find out during this week, that's emptiness. There's some wonderful stuff about reality on the way this week. I'll say a wee bit about the reflection just now too, can say more about it later. The jhanas are higher states of consciousness that can be attained in meditation. Sangharakshita, in his survey of Buddhism, he quotes a simile for the first jhana. It begins, free from sensual desires, free from evil thoughts, one attains and abides in the first jhana of joy and pleasure, which is accompanied with reasoning and investigation and arises through meditation, samadhi. Traditionally, this is how one reflects on one of the three characteristics of existence, the lakshanas, which are impermanence, suffering, and emptiness. This week, our reflection is on emptiness. So each day, we'll progress deeper into an understanding of emptiness guided by the Harp Sutra. Following this quote, at the afternoon reflection period in the Shrine Room, before reflecting or reasoning, as this quote has it, we'll try and calm our minds with just a few minutes of quietness, of just sitting. It's quite important in reflection to start off with your mind clear and free from too many disturbing thoughts. Reflection, like meditation, requires concentration. It's essential that we do try to be focused and to be aware of any extraneous thoughts that intrude into our reflection. From experience, I can say that it's easy to lose the thread. But if this happens, just take time to calm your mind for a moment or two. And I find it quite helpful if I'm being distracted a bit, just to say to myself, be still, be calm, and try and let your mind settle down without too much disturbance in it, and then return to your reflection again. But as I said, like meditation, reflection does require quite one-pointed concentration. If you can focus on the subject of it. And of course, for this week, that subject is going to be emptiness. I'll be handing out to you a few suggestions on, in fact, I've made out five, but they're just suggestions as we progress through the week of subjects to meditate on. It'll be essentially what we've been talking about that day. But don't go too far ahead. I'll give them out and they're all there, but just take them as we go along. So, fine. Now for the Heart Sutra. I'll read it out, this translation of it. This is Khonsa's translation. The Heart Sutra. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. Avalokita, the holy lord and bodhisattva, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. He looked down from on high. He beheld but five heaps, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. Hear, O Shariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Here, O Shariputra, all dharmas are marked with emptiness. They are not produced or stopped, not defiled or immaculate, not deficient or complete. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, nor feeling, nor perception, nor impulses, nor consciousness. No eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. No forms, sounds, smells, tastes, touchables, or objects of mind. No sight organ element, and so forth until we come to no mind consciousness element. There's no ignorance, no extinction of ignorance, and so forth until we come to there's no decay and death, no extinction of decay and death. There's no suffering, no origination, no stopping, no path. There is no cognition, no attainment, and no non-attainment. Therefore, O Shariputra, it is because of his indifference to any kind of personal attainment that a bodhisattva, through having relied on the perfection of wisdom, dwells without thought coverings. In the absence of thought coverings, he has not been made to tremble. He has overcome what can upset, and in the end, he attains to nirvana. All those who appear as Buddhas in the three periods of time, fully awake to the utmost right and perfect enlightenment, because they have relied on the perfection of wisdom. Therefore, one should know the Pranya Paramita as the great mantra, the mantra of great knowledge, the utmost mantra, the unequaled mantra, a layer of all suffering. In truth, for what could go wrong? By the Pranya Paramita has this mantra been delivered. It runs like this. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening. All hail. This completes the heart of perfect wisdom. Homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. In this invocation, lovely can be translated as lady, and it's addressed to the mother of the Buddhas, Pranya Paramita. That's actually what we were chanting last night. We were chanting Om Namo Bhagavataya Arya Pranya Paramitaya. Let me read you what Khonsa says about this. It's quite interesting. He says, Well, this is homage to the perfection of wisdom, the lovely, the holy. The word Bhagavati, which I have rendered as lovely, can also be translated as lady. Arya is not only holy, but also noble, and is an attribute of the Buddhas and of those of their disciples who have definitely turned away from this world to the world of the spirit. It is difficult to say about this invocation much that is of use to the general reader. Its repetition should help us to raise our minds in reverence to the perfection of wisdom as the mother of the Buddhas, as our guide through the world, and as the embodiment of perfect purity. So that's what you're aspiring to for this week when you're chanting Introduction to the Perfection of Wisdom to the Heart Sutra. We're aspiring to that this week through the chanting and through our study, reflection and meditation. So the sutra starts, Avalokita, the holy lord and bodhisattva, was moving in the deep course of the wisdom which has gone beyond. He looked down from on high. He beheld but five heaps, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. Now Avalokita, or Avalokiteshvara as we usually know him, I think Eshvara actually means Lord. So Avalokita is Lord Avalokita. Avalokita is the bodhisattva of compassion, and whilst he's deep in the practice of perfection of wisdom, and this is a wisdom which has gone beyond, which transcends all that is worldly. And from that place he looks down on the world and perceives with compassion the suffering of all beings. But what he beholds is five heaps. The Sanskrit for heaps is skandhas, the five skandhas. And to progress towards the wisdom and the emptiness the sutra is pointing to, it's really essential to have a clear view of the five skandhas. The five heaps are the five skandhas. The heaps are, you could say, heaps of phenomena, of elements, which are endlessly reducible. And every element in the heap is itself reducible. There's nothing which is fixed in the heap. They are in a continuous flux of change. And even if you were able to take one element from the heap, that element itself would be itself a continuous process of change. Nothing within it fixed or permanent. It would be endless reducible. Never anything. You could never arrive at anything that was fixed, that you could say had a degree of permanence in it whatsoever. That's what the heaps are. Heaps of elements that are in a continuous process of change. Shifting, rising every moment in dependence on conditions. And the five heaps, form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Form, which is rupa, covers the material or physical aspect of the world, and it comprises chiefly the four material elements of earth, water, fire, and air. Buddhism often termed hardness, fluidity, heat and vibration. Feelings, vedana, are, well, they range from the very pleasant, from the ecstatic, if you like, the most pleasing thing we can imagine, right through the neutral to suffering, or what is most unpleasant in us. they are. Then that range of that's feelings through very pleasant to the worst you can imagine, suffering. So that's feelings. Perceptions, Samya, perceptions arise through the six senses. Well, the five senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue. But mind in Buddhism is often looked upon as being a sort of sixth sense. We do experience sense objects, objects that arise in mind. So it's referred to often as the sixth sense. So we've got perceptions and then impulses. Impulses are literally together makers. It's also variously translated as volitions, tendencies, strivings. It actually includes all active dispositions. It's the impulse that sort of precipitates an action, precedes the actual action. Consciousness, vijnana, that's the awareness of something. It's the awareness that arises when a sense organ contacts a sense object, and then that element of awareness or consciousness arises. So these are the five skandhas. They constitute our personality and the entire range of our experience of ourselves and of external objects in relation to us. But it's really quite essential to get that idea of the skandhas, that they are five heaps. They're not something, they're not five lumps that are fixed. They're in a continuous process of change, a continuous process of becoming. And if you take any one particle out of it, it in itself, again, is the same as the actual heap. It's like a wee heap again. It's a continuous process of change. You can analyse it, try and reduce it, take it apart, but you'll never come to the end of it. Okay? It's infinitely reducible, or as near infinite as it's possible to get. A scientist might say that. You'll never arrive at that point where you say this is something fixed in this heap, right?
So the use of the word heap, Pasada, then that's quite deliberate, isn't it, to have a word, because a heap has to be an inconclusive bundle, doesn't
that's
it?
Right.
It's not a collection or an inventory or something. There's something a bit random about a heap.
There is. There's nothing. Well, in a way, you could say it's just a flux that's constantly changing. There's so many conditions in that heap. You know, if you take everything that constitutes form is in that heap. But, I mean, just imagine the number of elements that there are in form. I'm not talking about basics, what is it, 92 basic elements, that. But you know, everything that is form. Everything in herself, well, that is physical, the chairs, everything, mountains, everything, they're in form. I mean, imagine the mass of conditions that's there all the time, and each condition is causing something to arise. So you just have this flux. That's what each heap is. Forms, feelings, perceptions, impulses or volitions or will, is that impulses, is that will before an action and consciousness. They're all heaps with nothing, you'll never find anything fixed in them. You'll never find anything fixed in a heap, in that constant process of change. And as the sutra says, to see the skandhas in their own being, in their own being, they were empty, it says. If you read that bit again. Avalokita, the Holy Lord, was moving the deep source of the wisdom which is gone beyond. He looked down from on high, he beheld but five heaps, and he saw that in their own being they were empty. So to see them in their own being is to see them as they really are, is to see their true nature. Their true nature. And their true nature is that they're empty of the self that we impute on every object. We project onto every object a self. We perceive something, we perceive a person, and immediately we impute a name or it's a person. Or we look at a table or a chair and immediately we recognise that and we impute on it a self. We say that's a chair. And as soon as we say that, we give it permanence, or a degree of permanence anyway.
Well, if I see a chair, right, what I see is reflections and colours and things like that. And then I twig it's a chair. Or realise that's what we in the human race call a chair.
Well, that's right.
Is one of them samnya and the other one's...
Well, what's samnya? Tell me again.
What, perception.
Perception. Well, when you perceive anything, you know it. We've put a label on a chair. We've labelled it chair, and we immediately say that's a chair. Uh-huh. And as soon as we do that, we do give it a degree of permanence, you know, and we separate it from everything else. But that's not how it really is. In its own being, it's not how it is. It's only that we impute that. Conventionally, if you like, it's a chair. But ultimately, it's not. It's something that's a part of that flux of form.
It's a chair process.
A process. A process.
Can I ask a question? A lot of modern science that analyses and indeed reduces phenomena to basic elements, as you said, is dispassionate in its approach. I take it that Avalokita, as the Bodhisattva of compassion, has this perception, and that's a puzzle all on its own, given the perception itself is, if you like, part of the heaps, and yet nevertheless he perceives. But that this comes out of compassion, and that this is directed through and impelled, I even want to say, by compassion. Can you say something about that?
Yeah, well, as you say, Avalokiteshvara is the Bodhisattva of compassion. And when he looks down, when it says he looks down from high, he's looking down from that plane, if you like, of perfect wisdom. And this is a wisdom that transcends everything that is worldly. You know, and he sees five heaps. He sees that there's this process of change that you can put into five heaps, if you like. You could make as many as you like, but there's five heaps. And his compassion arises because he sees the suffering of beings who don't see it in the same way as him. We're seeing things as fixed, having permanence, and we want to grasp things that are permanent, make them permanent. Really, everything that we come in contact, we either want to make it permanent or reject it. We either are attracted to it, we want it, make it last, or go back to it, or reject it and just return to the pleasant. Always to make things permanent. And that's the cause of suffering. It's the first of the Four Noble Truths. So he's looking down from the level of transcendental wisdom and seeing that everything is a process of becoming. We are trying to make permanent, and we're suffering because of it. That is his compassion. He sees the suffering of beings because he's looking down on our ignorance.
Can you address the question, though, that nevertheless he perceives the heaps, and yet perception itself is part of the way the heaps are constituted. And so even, so if you like, nothing escapes, even Avalokita cannot escape the process of perception.
Well, we have to say that perception is conventional. You know, we label it that. He's seeing things as they really are, but he has to communicate on our level, if you like. He has to use the terms perception and seeing. His wisdom is a transcendental wisdom that I suppose you can still call it perception. He looks down and he, what does he perceive but five heaps? How else could you convey what he was doing other than saying it was his perception of it? So, but he's seeing in that perception, he's seeing things as they really are, that there are no perceptions ultimately.
So is there something profoundly paradoxical, such as that you get in the Diamond Sutra, going on here then?
Well, it's sometimes, as we go on, the next part we're coming to goes into this a wee bit, or I will go into it a bit. It can appear to be paradoxical. I don't think when you begin to truly see what the Heart Sutra is saying, the paradox becomes more apparent than real. I don't think it's paradoxical at all. But even Konza talks about paradox in the next part, which I don't entirely agree with. But well, that's up to you to decide then too when we come to it and think about it and use it. This is what our reflection is to be about, of course. And I can, in the end, make suggestions for reflections. But in reflection is really your own individual penetration of what it's saying, guided by the Heart Sutra. It's our reflection on emptiness. We're not really reflecting on the Heart Sutra. We're reflecting on emptiness, guided by the Heart Sutra. And our first taste of emptiness is this, in this very first statement about the heaps. You know, it says that in their own being they are empty. And that is because he's seeing the heaps as heaps of phenomena which are in a continuous process of change, with never an instant of permanence that you could find anything and define it as a self, something fixed. I mean, you couldn't find an element in that and say, this is whatever. Because in the instant of saying it, it's changed, it's arisen. Independence on conditions unchanged. There is nothing permanent. That's its emptiness. The sutra, as it goes on, is pointing to emptiness all the time. And it goes more explanatory as we go along, trying to fully understand what it's pointing to, what it's pointing to conceptually. The sutra, I see it as being in two parts. The first main part is the sutra going through things systematically and pointing to emptiness. The second part is how the bodhisattva or a practitioner actually goes beyond the concepts, transcends the concepts, and goes towards enlightenment. Hopefully, we'll dig into that a bit more systematically as we go along. So any more questions, any thoughts on it?
Could you say a wee bit about vijnana, Prasada? I think I'm interested in the V bit of vijnana, the sort of divided bit in vijnana. Sometimes I've heard people talk about vijnana as being a divided or a bifurcated consciousness. Can you say anything about that?
Well, essentially, consciousness implies duality. So it is, in a way, divided then. I mean, when I am conscious of you, I'm conscious of you being separate from me and separate from the person sitting next to you. You know, that it implies a duality. Consciousness actually implies a duality. That awareness of objects that we identify and put a conventional label on. Mm. I mean, I label you Dasanich. Yeah. I look over there and I say Susidi. Mm. I've implied a duality right away. Mm-hmm. Separation. Mm. And from myself and any object, the chair, the table, everything I've implied. Yes, sorry.
When people use the word conventional, they impute something problematic about it, that it's perhaps in some way illusory. And yet, for most people, the conventional is not problematic at all. Yeah. Can you say conventional to function?
If we didn't have things conventionally labelled, we couldn't function, could we? I mean, we wouldn't have language. Language is all conventional. Mm. We use it to talk, to do everything. But ultimately, it's by convention. Ultimately, this is what the sutra is going to come to.
Okay.
That there are two truths, conventional truth and ultimate truth. But we'll really be getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, you know, jumping into that at the present moment. Even when we go to the end of the week in Nagarjuna, this is central to his whole doctrine, the two truths of convention and ultimate, and the middle way between the two. As I said in my introduction, it's the middle way between existence and non-existence that we're going towards. By the end of the week, I really hope that we'll all see that middle way.
Word
speak
empty.
Up.
Sorry, I get a little bit troubled by the word empty, but what I'm hearing you say, though, is that you're referring to the word empty as really being just change. It's not that something, or there isn't anything there, it's more that everything constantly changes and is in a flux. Is that, I just want to be clear about that, sort of right at the beginning, that's what we're talking about here.
That's good, that's exactly what it is.
I
mean, emptiness isn't something, it's not a black hole, it's not a big void.
Yeah.
And the old system that we used for the Heart Sutra, it was translated as the primal void, which was just terrible, really. It was making it into a something. It was reifying emptiness, which mustn't be done. Well, it's just totally wrong if you try and reify emptiness. Reifying anything is anathema to the perfection of wisdom. But you've got it right. It's not something. It is the process of change, just.
I think we probably need to just keep reminding ourselves of that all week, don't we? Because it's so easy to look for something that it's challenging for our minds to stay focused on the flux, isn't it? It's easier to move towards a sense of a thing or a no thing.
Yes.
That's the whole middle way, isn't it? So I think we have to keep reminding ourselves that it's...
Okay, you just have to set my little apple cart.
That's how you, Richard.
And there is always a temptation to simplify. you know, so we can handle things. And I was quite happy with the idea that emptiness meant, you know, I'm empty of reality, or, you know, as it refers to the five scanners, quite okay with that. So this is a wee bit different then. It's a flux, a changing. We used to have the law of dependent origination on that tree outside, didn't we? And I was kind of happy with that. We don't see it as reality, or any part of me as reality. That's the way I kind of took it.
That's the way you looked at it.
Mm. So I'm kind of happy with that.
Well, you're not wrong in that okay. you're not ultimate. There's no, if you want to put it that way, you can't say me or you.
Yes, that's great, thanks. Yep.
Ultimately, all you can say is the process of me. I am a process of becoming.
Thank you.
I am Richarding.
Thank you, Prasad.
Fundamentally different from saying that you're non-existent.
Yes.
It's not about, I mean, that's part of the thing, isn't it? Is what does it mean for something to be existent or not existent? That's part of the whole problem that we're trying to get at.
So why fundamentally different? What's the difference?
This is as Posada says, we're looking at the conventional and the ultimate, and that it's very easy for us to set the ultimate above the conventional and say, well, the conventional, that's not really real, that's not really what we're interested in, and the ultimate is something, well that's where the truth is. But, you know, we've got to sort of, I think, reassess the way we bring our views to bear on the way we use those words to look at, well, what is the nature of our experience, the nature of our existence, which at one level is very, very real, but it's not quite the way we think it is.
And it's good that these questions come up like that, because in some ways they're showing that there's an understanding of it coming, because you're getting ahead of the sutra. The sutra is going to deal with some of that as it goes along, but I mean, it's good to have the idea of it before it comes up. At first reading, the sutra isn't always too clear, but a good discussion on it sometimes makes it look, oh, it's really quite straightforward in a way.
Can I come back to the chair and the scandalous?
Uh-huh.
Just to test my understanding of, because I noticed you talked about your chair in terms of sannyā, and then you had this question about vinyana. So my understanding of what's happening there is the raw sense data is the sannyā. You can't separate that from the next experience, which says, here's the chair, which is vijnana. It's either a chair that I want to do something with, or it's a chair that I have no interest in whatsoever. So there's a vedana association, pleasant, painful, and neutral. I want to do something or not. But then the impulse to do something is already is the samskara. So you've already got four of the skandhas coming into play in that moment of recognition that it's a chair, or in that moment of perception. That moment of perception is that moment of recognition. Might have an association with it, some kind of desire to respond. That desire to respond is based on some kind of feeling in relationship to that object. Is that that's my understanding of how this
thing works? I mean, we've got to recognise that from... we're born, we're being taught the conventional, the phenomenal world that we're dwelling in. I mean, to dwell in the phenomenal world, we have to have that recognition that a perception immediately is identified and labelled. With a designation, you know, for everything.
Yeah.
That's that. And it immediately, that's what arises in the perception. But then, if we've been studying this, we think, is it? And it's not as we actually see it. That's what this is saying. it's conventionally real. It's not unreal in that it's of the phenomenal world. It's real in the phenomenal world, the everyday world of experience. That's how we experience and label things, and it's how we function. But if we see emptiness, we can then begin to say, ah, but ultimately that never really comes into substantial existence. It's empty of substance because it's just a flow. But then as we go deeper, we begin to see that these are two truths, two separate truths, and we begin to find the middle way between it.
So there's nothing duplicitous in our experience as such?
No. It's ultimately, though, it is ignorance of how things really are. Because in their true nature, they are all... Their true nature is, in effect, no nature. It's emptiness. Because they never come into ultimate, substantial existence. Somebody said to me a while ago, you can't put your hand in a river in the same place twice. And my response was, yes, that's very true, but it's even more true to say that you can't put your hand in a river in the same place once. You can put your hand in a river in the same place in relation to the river bank, maybe. Well, theoretically you can. You can't even do that, really. But in a river that's a flow, can you say this is a fixed point in the river? I mean, the river's a flow. It's, your hand's not in a fixed place at all.
There isn't a river.
So that's how everything is.
Yeah. I mean, something
I can see the danger here. Sorry, I think I'm going to get more out. I'll keep trying to relate what you're telling me with what I know, and I'm blocking it. I think that's what's happening. So I need to be open. I'm sorry, I just recognise that. I'm not listening. Well, I am, but I'm constantly referring to what I think I know, and that's not helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, right. The point is that, you know, if you can see things as being a flow, you're never going to get a moment of permanence in it. It's just going, as I say, analogy I was trying to give there of the river, that you put your hand in, but it's not in a fixed place. In relation to river, I mean, you might say, ah, but there's a pool in a river and that's stopped. But, I mean, that's got a different designation. It's in relation to a river I'm talking about. So when I'm talking about in relation to Dasani, for a fixed place, there's no fixed place in it.
So what you're saying is nothing is ever anything because it's always moved on to be something else.
You reach out to grasp anything and it's changed before you can grasp it. And that's what we're always trying to do. We're trying to make things permanent. We want to hold on to things. Things that we like, we want to hold on to them. Things that we don't like, we reject and want to go back to the pleasant and hold on to the pleasant. But things are in a continuous process of change. Never an instant of permanence. Never an instant that you can identify a self or a soul. There is nothing fixed.
There are at least two different fundamental modes of understanding. One is synthetic and the other is analytic. The mode that all of this is seems to be deeply, richly analytic, hence all that you've said. And yet the sense of our experience is a constant synthesizing of what we know. So something very vividly that's going on at the moment, you know, those 50 workers at the nuclear plant in Japan who are almost certainly going to die of radiation sickness. The sense of all of that can, as it were, you can approach it analytically and, as it were, make the sense of that and the compassion that goes out to those people disappear. You know, you can chop it down into lots of little bits and say, well, these are the, if you like, these are the electrons in the nuclear reactor, and this is what happens to human flesh when it starts to come into contact with these electrons, and so on. You can, as it were, you can analyse it, write down, and the people have disappeared, if you like. The very people whose actions are provoking our compassion. And so how is a purely analytic mode of understanding helpful in, as it were, the way we actually negotiate the world and its perils and to say nothing of say the oppression of the people in Libya right now. Again, you can sort of analyse it down, so that you enter into a point of equanimity towards them, and yet the bodies keep piling up.
Well, that's how it is. Everything is arising in dependence and conditions. You know, the bodies are irradiated by, and flesh reacts to it and causes a reaction or an arising that ends in death. I mean, it's one process of dying, which we're all doing. We're all moving towards it, but in dependence on conditions. I mean, our life is perhaps the best subject for reflection on, to see that there is nothing fixed. From the very moment of our birth or even our conception, it's just a process, an inevitable process of dependent arising to the moment of death.
I can hear Macbeth's words in the background, though, signifying nothing. And I don't think Buddhism says that it signifies nothing.
No, it doesn't signify nothing. I don't see that signifies nothing. It signifies how things really are, that they are a continuous process of dependent arising. If the conditions are there, it arises.
Yes, but given that... So what is the status of human signifying them? Because, I mean, you talk about imputing a self, and you can say that, well, that indeed is what we do, and that the significance of the world arises, perhaps, because we impute. But we can't even begin to imagine not imputing. Mm-hmm. So we are caught up in a world that signifies.
But Buddhism neither reifies nor denies completely the conventional world. So the compassion in everything is, in fact, the compassion is there because it's the it's recognised its unsatisfactoriness. Just because it is, we perceive it as a continuous, because we perceive, try to perceive it as having things fixed in it that we can hold on to. But ultimately, there isn't. That's when he looks down and perceives that the five skandhas are empty. That's what he's seeing. I mean, he's recognizing the conventional world, our experience of the phenomenal world. And the phenomenal world is an unsatisfactory experience, ultimately, because everything is changing. There's nothing we can hold on to. We're going to die. Our friends are going to get irradiated and suffer. But that's how it is. I mean, that's the process of change. That is the compassion of Avalokiteshvara when he sees that we suffer because we are trying to make permanent what is... Mm-hmm. Inevitably, impermanently. But the whole thing is pointing towards transcending it To take the Heart Sutra or any of the perfection of wisdom without going beyond the concepts of it is a mistake. That's what it's pointing towards all the time. This is how it is, but to go beyond it, to really see how things are, to dwell in that sort of mode of being, is to transcend the concepts, is to transcend the conventional and go beyond. I mean, that's what makes the difference between Buddhism just being a philosophy, if you like, and being of something that is transcendental. We can go beyond the concepts, and that's what this is pointing to, that it's pointing to emptiness, reflect on it, ultimately, through reflection, to go beyond reflection, to go beyond the concepts that we're using in reflection, to transcend them and go into, Sutra has it, the Bodhisattva dwells in that mode that's beyond the concepts that it is presenting us with. This is only concept. It's only, as the Buddha said, it's only a raft to take you to across the stream.
I'm just, you know, thinking about the question of compassion. My sense of, I'm not like any sense of going beyond, but my, you know, my reflective sense, if you like, of going beyond that, of truly understanding how things really are, would give rise to infinite compassion. You know, would be a falling away of a compassionate response to the world. It would be, you know, an infinitely compassionate response to the world. So compassion would arise would arise out of that experience of wisdom, of the perfection of wisdom.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
it's full of compassion.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's the flip side of the coin of wisdom. Mm-hmm. Wisdom, compassion.
So is what makes Buddhism then, really, that we're not just saying that this is an analytical process and that's just coldly the way things are, but the entire Buddhist system exists then to give compassion to suffering. It's addressing that business of not seeing everything the way it is, but it's just purely just really addressing suffering. So it is full of, you've got the whole business that everything is just the way it is, and like you were saying, that's kind of just the way it is, that people will die in death of circumstance, whatever, but that doesn't mean that you can still have lots of compassion for the either the form of the people or for the people or whatever who you want to look at, really. Is that
the whole point is the alleviation of suffering.
Yeah, exactly.
The point isn't to have sophisticated understandings or concepts of reality. Yeah. Yeah. That any sophisticated understanding of reality we might have is just there to help us actually realise that in order to move towards that,
to go beyond
that compassionate situation.
I can see here the kind of deal, you know, it's like, you know, when you talk about convention and point, use the word pointing. I suppose, you know, I can only point to what it is I would like to kind of experience. I understand. I can see if I lived, you know, in the days of Copernicus and the world was flat, and, you know, we could see the end of it, and you come along with the perception of an astronaut and tell me not only is falling off ridiculous, you know, the world's round anyway, that's going to seem to me like a conceptual abstraction from my flat earth point of view. So I suppose it's really a matter of just keeping quiet and listening and, you know, letting go, I think, really, isn't it? That's what it feels like, to let go of what I think I know.
Yes.
I mean, I'm getting understanding what I see.
Concert. Dr. Edward Conza, the translator of the sutra, has three points of view on emptiness, which are quite interesting, but they're just views. He says that etymologically, emptiness, that's in Sanskrit, it's shunyata, conveys the idea that something that looks like something much is really nothing. Etymologically, emptiness conveys the idea that something that looks like something much is really nothing. As a spiritual term, emptiness denotes the complete denial of, the complete liberation from, the world around us in all its aspects. As a spiritual term, emptiness denotes the complete denial of, the complete liberation from, the world around us in all its aspects. As a Buddhist technical term, it denotes the absence of any kind of fixed self or soul. That's an Atman in Buddhist terms. In the Buddhist time, Brahmanism believed in an Atman, or which I think loosely translated as a soul, which was eternal, fixed, something fixed that went on forever and ever. And the Buddha declared that it was an Atman. There was no Atman, no fixed self or soul. So as a Buddhist technical term, it denotes the absence of any fixed self or soul. So the first one, the etymologically, emptiness conveys the idea that something that looks like something much is really nothing. That's the ultimate. It really is. That's emptiness. Really is the insubstantiality of everything, that it ultimately doesn't come into substantial existence. So it really is no thing. It never becomes a thing. If it's a flow, it's never coming into substantial existence that you could say that is a thing. Okay? And as a spiritual term, emptiness denotes the complete denial of the world around us. Well, again, that's treating it as ultimate emptiness, that it never comes into substantial existence. It's never fixed. Okay? But it's also the complete liberation from the world around us in all its aspect. If you have fully realized and transcended it and you're dwelling in that emptiness, to use the term, then you're completely liberated from attachment to things. You're not trying to grasp any longer, to make permanent what is impermanent. So you're not suffering. So you've got a complete release from the conventional world, from the phenomenal world, if you like, the world of phenomena, the flow of conventional experience. And then there's a Buddhist term, it's no self or soul.
And yet, I mean, this is where it seems to get very obscure and subtle, because there isn't even a self that is liberated.
There's no self to be liberated.
No.
That's liberation, when you realise that.
Yeah.
When there's no fixed self. You can say that there's a conventional self. I mean, you can't really deny that we experience things. And when you say, I experience, then you have got you're imputing a conventional self to yourself.
And this is one of the features of this sutra, it seems to me, is that it oddly, whilst it addresses Sariputra, we have no sense of his presence.
No, it's he's not replying. It's not a dialogue.
No.
No. But we'll say a wee bit of that in the next section that comes up about Sariputra. Because Sariputra was renowned for his wisdom.
From what I've gathered from what was just said, that awakening then would be that awakening would be awakening to the idea that there is no one to be awakened.
Well, that would be
okay.
Part of it, yes, that there was no fixed entity.
Oh, come on.
It would be the complete realization of the middle way between existence and non-existence.
So I've never heard it put like that.
Between existence, that's the middle way, which we'll go into in some depth with Nagarjuna's middle way, fundamental wisdom of the middle way.
I really like this first definition, Pasada, the etymological one, that something that looks like something much is really nothing. I like that one because I think it sort of addresses the human condition, doesn't it, that we grasp. That we see things and we make them into that we see stuff and we make it into things rather than seeing phenomena.
Yeah.
And we relate to ourselves as a thing. And we in our minds we make our experience more concrete and solid than it is. I find that really helpful, that definition. Because it sort of it points at the illusory nature of how we see and how we live.
It's here, O Shariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. The same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. Here, O Shariputra, form is emptiness, and the very emptiness is form. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. Whatever is form, that is emptiness. Whatever is emptiness, that is form. So here means on the level of Abhidhamma, compassionate transcendental wisdom. And Shariputra, one of the Buddha's main disciples, was renowned for his wisdom of the Abhidharma, especially the analysis of the five skandhas into their constituent existent elements of experience. And they call these dharmas. Quite distinct from the Dharma, but these elements that they consider to be have inherent existence, to be elements of experience that were had a self, had a fixed self. Right? Avalokiteshvara, however, is teaching a transcendental wisdom. His wisdom is the wisdom that has gone beyond. It's quite important to understand the statement that form is emptiness and the very emptiness is form is not illogical. This is what's often referred to as being paradoxical, and I quite honestly don't see it as being paradoxical. Even Konza, I think he says something like, this is paradoxical because it's saying that emptiness, if form isn't form, it's emptiness. But that emptiness is form. And he says, in other words, it's saying A is not A, but what is not A is A. That is paradox. But I don't really think it's saying that at all. It's not a paradox, as he has, I'm sure. I think what has been conveyed is really just that form and emptiness are not two separate things. You know, there could be no emptiness without the form. You know, it says form is emptiness, so there couldn't be the emptiness without the form. Mm-hmm. But form wouldn't be form if it wasn't empty. At least it wouldn't be form as we experience it if it wasn't empty. Do you get that? That it wouldn't be form as we experience it if it wasn't empty. Our experience of it is, the way we experience it is because it is empty. It's because it's empty, it is a flow of phenomena. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't empty, it would be something fixed, permanent. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't be continuously changing.
So, have to be
so it would be something that never changed.
We can't imagine what form would be like if it wasn't empty.
You couldn't, because you would be fixed.
There isn't a way that you can really imaginatively engage with that, is there?
So
that's then what arises to suffering, because if something was fixed, you would have control of that. You could get what you wanted that was fixed, and then you wouldn't have to suffer.
Well, this it goes into the real depth of understanding as we go on. This the difference here. So,
can I just ask you a bit more about this word form? Because it's a word in Western philosophy, and it's something to do with what's intelligible. And I'm not sure that form means that within the sutra, does it?
Well, form consists essentially of the physical world, what is material, of the basic, you know, the original idea, earth, water, fire and air, the four basic elements that everything is constituted on, and that. So it's everything that Buddha says, everything that's got hardness about it. But it includes hardness as form, but it includes earth, water, fire and air. So it's everything in the physical world, really. Everything that makes us, our physical aspect of us,
yeah.
Not the psychic, you know, of feelings, perceptions, impulses and consciousness.
So those aren't part of form?
Those aren't form.
I see.
That's why they're separated into the different heaps, you know, form, feelings, perceptions, impulses and consciousness.
So form is one of the heaps?
Form is one of the heaps.
Yeah. So it isn't even anything to do about what we perceive or what we don't perceive. It's just what's there.
It's just what's there.
Yeah.
It's just the physical. Yeah. What makes up the physical world. So, they're really, you know, what it's really just saying here is that you cannot separate form and emptiness. Or any of that. You can't separate the five skandhas and emptiness. It's not just form. It's using form, but the same is true of feelings, perceptions, impulses and consciousness.
So in a sense then, it's another way of pointing to the fact that emptiness isn't a thing, because emptiness is just Pratitya-samutpada. Yeah, that's right, isn't it?
It's synonymous with Pratitya-samutpada, yeah. But you could look at emptiness in this case when it's saying like this as being a characteristic or an attribute of form or feeling or perception or impulses of consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's how form is. It's empty. It's a flow. It never comes into substantial existence. I mean, form is empty. It's like saying water is wet, but wet is water. Form is emptiness, but emptiness is form. They're not two separate things. Form and emptiness aren't distinctively separate. In fact, emptiness isn't a thing. Emptiness is just how form is.
So what I see this doing is, in a way, somehow disenchanting us from the impulse towards wanting things to be fixed, wanting them to be substantial, and that's something very deep within us, that so we don't want things to be empty. We want them to...
But we don't want them to be empty because we don't understand emptiness. If they weren't empty, they'd be fixed and there would be no life. If things didn't change, there'd be no life. Life has changed. The universe has changed. The world has changed. If it was all permanently fixed, if it all had inherent existence, without the possibility of change. If something didn't exist, it couldn't come into existence. If something was existing, it couldn't go out of existence. If it was permanently fixed, permanent.
Why is it described as empty and not changing? It's kind of use of, I get quite caught up in use of language, but why do we refer to it is empty and not changing? Because that, it seems to me that that's what we really mean.
Empty rather than changing, why use the term empty?
Well, it's what it's saying is that it's empty of substance. It's insubstantial. Emptiness means insubstantiality in a way. Because it's a flow, it never comes into substantial existence.
The difficulty with saying it's changing is to lead with the idea that there is a thing which is subject to change. So I think that the reason for some of the thoroughness and repetition is to keep sort of bringing us back into our subconscious assumptions about what's happening.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You want another question, or do you have to? You want to roll on? I think of emptiness as the way things work. That's the way things work. That's conditionality, Paticca Samuppada. And form, well, it's discriminative consciousness. The way things work is by changing all the time conditionality. But we're sticking to forms. If you think it's a thing, then you're denying the way things work.
Well, yes, because that if you think it's a thing, you're fixing it. You're reifying what is, isn't fixed. If you reify anything, you make it into something that has inherent existence. But nothing has inherent existence.
Right. Well, that's what discriminative consciousness is doing all the time. Vijnana.
Yeah.
Which is...
We're trying to reify everything.
Which is not the way things work.
That's right. Mm. It's not the way things really are.
Excuse me, what, Cecilia, you were saying, you used the phrase discriminative...
consciousness.
That kind of sounds like what makes the emptiness into something, is that...?
Okay. Yeah, you see a funny wooden thing there, and because of your life experience, you label it a chair.
Okay.
But actually, you can sit on an ornament box or a chest or whatever.
But I can't say I've created the chair.
Well, a chair isn't a chair and never anything else. Other things can act as chairs, and a chair can fall apart so that you can't sit on it at lunchtime.
Mm. Right, okay.
So it's a sort of lazy man's talk, calling it a chair.
It's also a chair, it's also a door stopper, it's also a not very good ladder, it's a very uncomfortable hat.
It can be an offensive weapon on a Friday night.
Yeah. or it could be, a bed for your cat. So it's not got an absolute being.
Yeah.
But, you can have a chair. I mean, it's reducible. You can take a leg off a chair and then, what do you call it, a three-legged chair or
or broken.
I mean, it's the analogy that the Buddha used of the chariot.
Yes.
What is a chariot? You know, if you start dismantling it, how long does it remain to be a chariot? And when does it just become wheels? And if you do it with a motor car, you know, they take the body off it. Is it a motor car? Is it take the seats out? Is it something different? So it's reducible right down to its elements, if you like. If you want to get too scientific about it, down to the atoms and that make it up. So it's infinitely reducible. Which is the same as this, is that it's a continuous flow. In a way, that's, you were sort of referring to that in a way, talking about the synthesized and the, you know, if you look at it from that aspect, that instead of seeing it as a flow, but you can see it as infinitely reducible. You can take it apart bit by bit and never cease taking it apart.
But that's my puzzle, because in our experience, the sense of things, for example, the men in the nuclear power plants, the sense of that in itself isn't reducible. It is what it is and not another thing. It's not, you know, if you analysed it or started to analyse it, you've already missed it, because it is what it is. And that's my puzzle. Because, as it were, the analytic method is such that, if you like, everything is reducible. The synthetic approach is to, as it were, to catch the sense of things, and just as you can't chop up the flight of a ball, you can only. There's the movement of the ball. I don't know if I'm making sense. The pattern of meaning where there are these men dying and their loved ones sort of 100 miles away getting messages from them as they die doesn't seem to me to be a situation where by analysing it you actually deepen your sense of what's going on.
No, it's meaningless to do that. It's completely meaningless to do that. It's not the that's not the point, really. So having an analytical analysis of something is not the be-all and end-all, and sometimes it's incredibly unhelpful. And what it does is it increases your ignorance, you know, rather than thins it out. So the fact that Nagarjuna and the Mahayana use tools of analysis doesn't mean that the point of the Buddhist life is to analyse things into constituent parts, because if the background condition of your mind is one of ignorance, is one of greed, hatred and ignorance, then you will analyse on the basis of greed, hatred and ignorance. Mm. You know? So there's something a bit more fundamental that has to be upturned, and there's a bit of a tragic history within the history of Buddhism of analysis going really wrong, actually, which is what Posada was talking about with the Abhidharma analysis into constituent parts that then became ultimate, and that created a huge difficulty, huge more than stumbling block in the history of Buddhism, which then the Mahayana had to work very hard to overturn. So you're right, what you're saying here is that certain kinds of analytical analysis actually don't point to the truth. They don't liberate you. They increase the sense of isolation.
Can I make just one point on that? Because I think one of the mistakes we make is we abstract ourselves from the analysis. Mm. And that's the Western scientific habit, is that we analyse things and objects. This analysis isn't about things and objects, it's also about us. We can't abstract our perceptions and our feelings and all of that stuff from the analysis. It's part of the analysis.
Yeah.
we're part of what's going on here. We're not abstract from it. And I think it's that is the Western science abstracts objects and analyses them, and that's one of the key differences between what we're trying to do and that.
So that's maybe that's and because of that background, there's a potential misreading of this.
I think we can fall into that. We can take ourselves out of the picture.
Yeah.
And we forget. Okay.
Yeah.
So what is that feeling that we have in response to that story?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's that about? You know, it's not just about to see what I mean. You've got to bring yourself and your feelings and your emotions and your that kind of more visceral world into the picture.
I mean, there's one picture of Western science as the view from nowhere, the view from nowhere, and in a way that this is a view from somewhere, but it's a transcendental somewhere.
And that trap of, you know, treating analysis sort of, there's a complete blind alley, isn't there, where we bring all of our assumptions and all of our greed, hatred, and delusion into our analytical process and completely miss the point.
You can never, I think you said somewhere that it is this, but nowhere can you say anything is or is not. You can never say something is or is not. There's never anything fixed that you can say it is or it is not. And we'll come to that tomorrow.